Let's see what else is on the menu for today's Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Catch 35, the perfect menu for your next business lunch. Guess what new business is in Chicago? Jim Dahlke, the senior editor at Chicago Inno, will join us. And speaking of buying and selling homes these days, Matt Schultz from LendingTree will join us. Also on the business lunch today, as does Elise Glink. Let's get started with you. Elise, how are you today?
I'm still thinking about pizza, and I never eat pizza on Halloween. We always have chili, but we're just outliers in so many ways.
Well, that's not too far out there. That sounds good, too. A good chili to me. Wow. Brenda and I had a Southwest soup over the weekend, which was kind of like a chili. It was kind of a Southwest chili, a bunch of beans and onions, and it felt really good. Like when you eat pizza, you don't go, that was a good idea. But when you eat a good hearty soup or chili, you feel like you may have actually done something good, you know?
Yeah. No, I agree completely. There's a lot of warmth involved with some green chilies. But we're seeing a little green, just to seg right over to the stock market.
Yeah,
feed,
how about
John.
That?
Little
639.
Green. 639. Yeah, it is just flying upwards today. Part of the good news, I think, is that GM sales were up significantly. They rose 24% in the third quarter. That was really well above, I think, what expectations are. But I did a little car shopping over the weekend. Couple of things that our listeners may not realize is that even though interest rates are now approaching or exceeding, depending on your credit score, 7% for a 30-year fixed rate loan, there for people who have great credit, you can still get under 3% if you're financing a new car. If, of course, you can find the new car to buy. Lots are looking pretty empty all over. Cars are in demand. And now with what's happened down in Florida with Hurricane Ian, we're going to see a shortage of cars.
It's funny. I was talking to a representative from State Farm earlier in the show today. 19,000 claims, 10,000 of them were for cars. Some of them swept out to sea, she said. But in Florida alone, 10,000 cars are no more.
Yeah, well, I think it's a lot higher than 10,000. Yeah. I think 10,000 is probably just was the opening for people who have enough electricity to be able to actually get online and file those claims, right?
That's a good point. Yeah, that was just claims. That wasn't the state total. That was State Farm's claims so far, now that you mention it.
Yeah, there's going to be a tremendous drag on the economy to start in the wake of Hurricane Ian. And of course, we've got President Biden going down to Puerto Rico. They got hit very badly also, and they really still hadn't recovered from, I think it was Maria. There's so many of these big, devastating once every 500 or 1,000 year hurricanes that you forget which one is which, but Puerto Rico, still very badly damaged, still a lot of people without power, and they never really recovered from the last one. So we're going to see a drag on the economy, and then I think we're going to see a boom down in Florida again as people struggle to figure out what they're going to do. But one of the impacts that I think we have to pay attention to, and we can talk about this coming back, is what do you do if you had rented a place in Florida on Airbnb or with one of the rental companies for the winter? And let's say it was on Sanibel Island.
Wow.
You might not be going.
Okay, let's pick it up there in a minute with Elise Glink. It's 12:21. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're talking to Elise Glink. She is the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. She's the host of This Week in Wealth with Tom Fortino. She'll be on with Tom Sunday at 6:30 a.m. You can always find her stuff at thinkglink.com. What else are you thinking about, Elise?
Well, one of the things that I'm thinking about is all these people in Chicago and New York, a lot of the northeastern folks who have rented places in Florida for the winter. One of the things that's happened, it's been kind of a systematic change since COVID a couple of years ago, where people who can work remotely have said, hey, why am I dealing with snow and cold? I might as well go somewhere warm and sunny. And so they rent places in Florida for a couple of weeks, a couple of months. And, you know, anybody who had rented on the west coast of Florida, particularly if you were in Fort Myers Beach, Fort Myers, Sanibel, Captiva, any of those West Coast locations, you know, that it's just destroyed. And so the first thing you want to do is if you rented with Airbnb or you rented with one of the real estate companies that handles those kinds of longer term leases, you probably want to get in touch with them if you can today to find out the state of that property and whether or not you can do it. I also got a really interesting study that crossed my desk this week, John, about whether you're going to make more money as a landlord if you do short-term rentals or more short-term rentals with Airbnb, or if you do kind of a standard long-term lease of a year or two. And depending on the location, the results vary. It's sort of interesting.
I would imagine if you get enough, if you had 52 weeks, you would make more money as an Airbnb. You'd have 52 weeks of headaches, but you would. Don't you think I'm right about that?
Well, it's interesting. In cities that have high tourism, the vacation rentals are more, the ones you're talking about, sort of the shorter terms, are more profitable. But you have a lot more opportunity for vacancies. And so the smaller units tend to work better as long-term rentals in most cities. But when it's a tourism area, then it's the vacation rentals with the short-term, even with the vacancies, that are more profitable. But it's interesting when you get into the higher-priced properties. And in Florida, you were seeing that already, and I'm sure this is going to triple now that there's such a lack of housing. But when you're seeing properties go for $5,000 a month, $10,000 a month, $20,000 or $30,000 a month, the long-term rentals tend to be more profitable there.
You were talking about Airbnbs. If I have made an advance payment for an Airbnb on a property that isn't there anymore, my goodness, or is not going to be usable, I can't imagine I'm on the hook for that, right?
Well, it depends on how you paid for it and whether the landlord or the owner of the property is inclined to, want to give that back to you. So what happened during COVID was Airbnb got a lot better about saying, right, this property is no longer available. Well, we're going to give you a year to use that down payment, or we're just going to give it back to you. And some of the long-term leases, somebody who might have rented for 3 months through a regular agency, you might have put that 10% deposit down on a credit card, you'd be able to get that back. You should read the fine print of whatever contract you signed, and then, of course, be sure to check in, because even if it says you can't get your money back, Hurricane Ian is an extraordinary event, and everyone may just be covered by insurance and they'll just give it back. If they're not covered by insurance, they may fight you for it.
Okay, well, I guess so. I mean, it just seems to me to be wrong with it, regardless of the insurance. I know you don't have your house. I'm sorry about that, but that's not my fault or obligation. I gave you money for something you're not providing. I'm sure I won't take the time to fight you in small claims, but doggone it, you should give me my money back.
I agree completely, John. And I think for the vast majority of people, they will get their money back. I also think it may take some time. So there are still 600,000 or 700,000 people without power in Florida. We're seeing, just the beginning of what the devastation looks like.
Yeah.
You can't really tell how bad it is. So we have some friends who did rent for 3 months, January, February, March of next year in Sanibel. And they looked at some of the, you can get some pretty good images from the news media, satellite imagery. There's a special website that's now apparently been set up for Sanibel owners to be able to check on their property since the causeway is down. Hmm. You can only get there by boat.
Oh, wow.
Or helicopter. And even though it looks like the house they were going to rent has all its roof tiles intact, most of what happened at Sanibel, and we know some other people who do have houses there, the first floors were just completely washed away. And so we saw some images over the weekend of houses that are owned by friends of ours or friends of friends. And the newer houses are all built with first floor breakaways. It's meant to break away and let the water rush through. However, the water was into the second floor. In some cases, that's how high the storm surge was. So it's really something you want to look into if you had at all thought about going to Florida or if you'd already rented a place.
I got time for just one last question from one of our listeners, Elise. Could you please ask John if you've contracted to rent Florida property, but not VRBO, not Airbnb, and the property area is badly damaged, are you responsible to pay the remaining amount due? Do you know the answer to that?
I would say I would not pay it. I'm not a lawyer.
I wouldn't either.
But I wouldn't pay it. I'd let them come chase you for it. But the first thing to do is reach out to whoever you rented it from and, of course, pull out your rental agreement and see what it says. But if they can't deliver it, I'd have a hard time imagining anybody's going to push you to pay the rest of it.
Listen, with Tom Fortino, Elise Glink, Sunday mornings at 6:30. You can check her stuff out at thinkglink.com. Let's talk next Monday, Elise.
Sounds good, John. Thanks.
12:38 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. John Williams here, and on Mondays about this time, Jim Dahlke usually joins us, senior editor at ChicagoInno.com. Thanks for saying hi. How are you today, Jim?
Hey, John. Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Good. I just got something hot off the presses. What am I looking at here? What did you write up, sir?
Yeah, so last week I had the chance to chat with Steve Case. Case is the co-founder of AOL and is a venture investor and backer of lots of startups across the U.S. and is really behind what he has titled The Rise of the Rest. This is really a mission that began back in 2014 as a bus tour across the U.S. He and a handful of investors on his team traveled to dozens and dozens of cities all across the heartland, all in every corner of the U.S. that wasn't named Silicon Valley, Boston, or New York, really looking to find startups that were kind of boosting their local economies. And now The Rise of the Rest is actually a book that he wrote, which launched last week. And I had a chance to chat with him about that book and about kind of his philosophy for investing and sort of belief in this Rise of the Rest movement, where he is seeing lots of companies outside of the traditional areas raise money. Chicago certainly being one of that. One data point that Case and his team point to is that the total percentage of seed funding and early stage funding that went to the Bay Area specifically fell below 30%. As early as 2014, the number was 40%. So more funding is going to more startups across the country, and that's certainly a big deal for Chicago.
He called it, or you called it, at least in your story about this, a tipping point for the Midwest. Why the Midwest? Why did it, or are we tipping?
Yeah, so that is a reference to the pandemic. So he really believes that the pandemic is this tipping point, right, where companies can sort of hire from anywhere, employees can work from anywhere, and this is a boost to the heartland, to the Midwest, to cities outside of Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley, for years and years was the tech epicenter. This is where you had to be if you wanted to be in the quote unquote innovation economy. That's no longer the case anymore. And, and Steve Case argues that, it's not just a handful of cities. It's not just the Austins, the Seattles, the Los Angeleses, the Miamis, yes, the Chicagos. It's way beyond that. It's the Richmond, Virginias, it's the Chattanooga, Tennessees, and these sort of, tier two and tier three cities, across the country that are seeing founders who once started their businesses in the Valley, once started their businesses in New York, Boston, come back home, perhaps where they grew up, maybe where they went to college. And what he's seeing is this, the brain drain that colleges saw for years and years and years is starting to recede a little bit. The University of Illinois graduates, one of the biggest, graduates of computer science degrees across the country. It was historically all those graduates left for the Valley. Many of them are staying around now.
Is it because people are able to work from home? I mean, it's still the same companies hiring these people, but it's where they're doing the job. And if that's the case, what does that say about these campuses that these tech companies have?
That's part of it. But, the other thing of it is that, these cities are just doing a better job of holding on to tech talent and producing successful tech companies. I mean, the one thing that, this Case and a lot of other investors that that have similar mindsets is they say, success begets success in these local towns. So when you see a big startup exit that maybe goes public, gets acquired for hundreds of millions of dollars, those employees, and those founders reinvest that money locally, create new businesses, invest in new local businesses. And so what you're seeing is just the maturity of some of these secondary cities like Chicago, which 20 years ago, you know, had a very little tech presence, but, you know, thanks to companies like Groupon and Grubhub and, you know, Ocean and Tempest and some of these more recent ones that are there, you know, growing really quickly and doing really well, it creates a bit of a flywheel, and you see a lot of reinvestment in Chicago and in cities like it across the U.S.
Let's talk about some of these companies. What's the news on Songfinch?
Yeah, Songfinch, one of my favorite companies in Chicago. They allow you to purchase personalized songs from artists. Yeah. So you can go on their website. You know, tell a little bit about the person you're trying to write a song for, a loved one or a friend, and they'll create a personalized song for you right there and turn it back in a few days. They just raised $17 million in funding. You know, they're a business that's grown really fast over the last couple of years. They're actually expecting to do about $40 million in revenue this year. That's up from just over $5 million a year ago, and now they're up to 40 employees. They got some pretty well-known investors, musicians like Doja Cat and The Weeknd. Quincy Jones is an investor in them as well. And so pretty interesting startup story and one of really the leading music tech companies here in town in Songfinch.
So if my husband or wife or boss or friend is retiring and we all want to have a song form crafted about them, that would be kind of cool. I presume that would be a use for Songfinch. And then what do you suppose that would cost?
So the costs range a bit, but it is very affordable. I'd have to look back and see what their rates are, but it's less than you think. And it really is, you know, kind of creating this like one of kind of experience. It's not that unlike, of course, a company we've talked about, Cameo, which lets you connect with artists, famous folks, and get us to shout out from them. You know, really what Songfinch is doing is letting you do that kind of on the music side. It's also a huge revenue stream for these artists. You know, of course, you know, to make it in the music business, you're trying to book gig after gig. Maybe you're busking on the street. You're trying to get as many gigs as possible. Songfinch lets you create music and get paid for it right from your home. And so it's really kind of opening up a new avenue of you know, for revenue for musicians in a way that really hadn't before.
Just give me the headline on this. There's a crypto company that's leaving Chicago. What's the story there?
Yeah, FTX, their U.S. operations were in Chicago. FTX had a big Super Bowl commercial the other year. You know, they had set up shop in Chicago. Their president is stepping down, and they are bringing their office to South Florida. So they're going to be a Miami-based company now. Yet another company that headed down to sunny Florida. So yet another trend we're seeing a bit locally.
Goes both ways, and that's the way it is. Jim Dahlke is the senior editor at ChicagoWinnow.com. Read this and more there. Nice to talk to you today, Jim. Thanks, as always.
Thanks, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. We've got more business news now with Dave Schwann.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. United Airlines is temporarily suspending service at New York's JFK Airport. The Chicago-based airline said their schedule was too small to remain competitive, especially with the start of the winter season. United said they'll continue to search for what they call a more desirable schedule and resume operations if and when it becomes available. The suspension begins October 29th. Kareem Daniel, chair of Media and Entertainment Distribution at the Walt Disney Company, has been named an independent director of the board at McDonald's. He's been with Disney for over 15 years, and his election brings a total of 15 board members to McDonald's. Yes, you are paying more at the pump in Chicago. Gas Buddy says average gas prices in the city are up over 20 cents a gallon in the last week, but a little over 9 cents lower than a month ago. That's your Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Dave Schwann.
Matt Schultz is on the Wintrust Business Lunch from LendingTree, and I'm looking at some statistics that I think you're going to talk to us about third-party payment plans or apps like Zelle. Now, thanks for joining us today. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
How popular are these peer-to-peer payment services?
Enormously popular and only getting more so. Our survey found that about 84% of folks say that they have used these services, and 44% say they use this stuff at least once a week. And the most common ones are the kind of household names that I think we all know, PayPal and Venmo, but they're very, very popular.
And you focused on how often people inadvertently send it to the wrong person, right? That happens frequently?
All the time. Anyone who has used Venmo or these other tools to any degree can understand how easy it can be to get the wrong name or to send something to the wrong person. And our survey showed that about a quarter of folks say that they've sent money to the wrong person. And if you're somebody who uses it multiple times a week, that number goes up to 30-40%. And that's a big deal, because it's not like credit card fraud or something like that where it's easy to get that money back. That money may just be gone.
People know that, though, right? That's the danger. That's the price you're paying for the convenience, correct?
Yes, that's at least one positive aspect of it, is that we found 70% of folks say that they know that they're liable. And I guess they're just willing to take that risk for the convenience, because it is really convenient and it does make things simpler. But you just have to understand what you're getting into.
Still, why does it have to be that way? I mean, it's not FDIC. These monies are not federally insured, right? There's no FDIC or any insurance program that's going to protect your exchange, correct?
That's correct, yeah. And then the good thing is that people do know that these things aren't FDIC insured either. About almost two-thirds of folks say that that they know that that's the case. So again, at least people seem to understand, or at least recognize the risk when they're going into this.
So other than being careful, is there any remedy for this? It would seem to me like the third party, they're part of this equation. It's how they're making money. How is it that I don't have some protection, or is any coming?
Well, there's as big as these are, there's no question that there's the possibility of regulation and more regulation in the future, because there's just so much money involved. So we'll see where this ends up going. But right now, the important thing is for folks to know that if they make a mistake, that chances are they may be out of that money.
What normally happens then? Do you call the person or message them and say, hey, that $1,000 was supposed to go somewhere else, please remit? I mean, is that the exchange that normally happens?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. I mean, you really are kind of relying on the kindness of strangers and picking up the phone or emailing or just DMing through the app and saying, hey, I sent you that $1,000. Can you send it back to me? And you would hope that somebody in that situation would have some mercy on you and send that money back. But as we know, that's not always the case.
You've never made this mistake, have you, Matt?
I have not, but I honestly don't use these tools as much as some other people do. But I have certainly had situations where I've been like, I've had to go back to the person I'm paying to say, hey, are you this person -17 instead of -15, and confirming like that. So it's absolutely worth making that extra call and asking that extra question.
I think the big question next year is going to be the IRS tracking these exchanges and maybe considering them taxable events, right?
Yeah, that's a pretty big deal, because there are a lot of small businesses, thinking of like handyman and housekeepers and artists and things like that, who get paid through Venmo pretty frequently. And the IRS has changed the threshold on how much money has to be involved before those things become taxable. And it's dropped it quite a bit. So it's going to change the game a fair amount for these businesses and prompt a little more tax paying and a little more tracking and reporting and that sort of thing.
Really interesting thoughts today from Matt Schultz, LendingTree's chief credit analyst. Visit LendingTree.com. Nice to talk to you today, Matt. Thanks for the heads up.
Yeah, thank you.